Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week on the show, we bring you two great American songwriters, James Taylor and Lucinda Williams. They're just a few years apart in age, children of the baby boom and the early rock and roll era. But their careers took a very different path. Taylor was just a kid when he recorded his first album at Apple Records in London, with help from the Beatles. And he really became a musical touchstone for his generation almost immediately. For Williams, it was the late 90s already when she was on her way to 50, and she had a hit with the record Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. It's an almost perfect mix of country and blues and folk, and it arrived just as a younger generation was falling in love with a genre now known as Americana. We're going to hear performances from both artists recorded at the New Yorker Festival, our annual bonanza that takes place over a weekend in October. To kick things off, here's James Taylor, who spoke with my colleague, staff writer Adam Gopnik.
James, this evening runs the risk of being an episode in the Chris Farley show. I don't know if you remember Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live, when he would have people he admired on, he would just say, do you remember when you wrote Fire and Rain? And say, that was great. And I could go through everything you've done and simply stand here and sweat and say, that was great. But I will try at least to find out why it's all been so great. Thinking about your music, one of the things that's always sort of stunned me about it is when you first appeared, you had a distinctive way of playing the guitar, which wasn't like anybody else's, distinctive kind of voicings, and you had an amazing harmonic language. You know, I always think when I go through your sheet music and see that wonderful song like Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight starts with an E minor ninth chord and then goes to a major seventh chord. Those weren't the C, A minor, F, G progressions of pop music at the time. Did you study music? How was it that the language of music came to be the language you speak so naturally?
I studied cello when I was a kid. My parents thought it would be good for it. There were five of us, and so I got the cello, and I played for about 4 years, badly, reluctantly. I was a bad student, and it never gave me the kind of feedback that I needed to have it take off and have its own momentum, its own reason to continue. But all along, I noticed that the guitar was going to be it for me, and I finally prevailed on my folks. We lived in North Carolina. My mother would bring little groups of us up on the train to Manhattan to expose us to something other than trees, and
was it art or music or
yeah, it was
the shows that she took you to?
Museums and shows, and the city itself. But you know, my folks loved the Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, My Fair Lady in South Pacific and Oklahoma, and some light classics and some folk music too. And, of course, I loved Elvis, and I loved the Beatles, and I loved Ray Charles when I was exposed to those things. That's sort of the second tier of stuff I was exposed to. That amazed me, too, and it just opened my eyes, and I wanted to explore that music, and I wanted to sing it, I wanted to play it. But I was 12 when I got a guitar here in Manhattan at Shermer's.
Really?
The Shermer Music Company.
So you drove up with your mother to...
Well, we took the train up, and I think it was my mom and my dad on that trip. And we went to Shermer's and found a guitar. I saw the Fender Electrics, the shape, the amazing finish of them, the way they looked, the chrome, the mother of toilet seat, you know. they wouldn't go for it. So it was a classic guitar, and I... You know, immediately I got, I'll show you what the first thing I ever played on it was. Simple, but It spoke to me, it just immediately started making sounds that I wanted to hear more of.
And
the cello never did.
You sold the cello at that point and pawned it on 46th Street.
I don't know what happened to that damn cello. It's got to be around somewhere. I hope someone's playing it.
And you started to compose just the way kids do, teenagers do on the guitar. You just chord to chord and idea to idea. What was the first song you ever wrote that you thought was a good song?
I wrote a song called, when I was 13 or 14, called Roll River Roll, which is pretty awful. I can play it for you.
Would you please?
Yes.
I don't think this is ever here. James Taylor's first song. Has this been widely covered, James?
No, it hasn't been widely covered. And the fact that nobody here tonight has ever heard it is proof of how lame it was. You know, it was really... This is something called Travis picking that we all learned.
Right.
Sort of a walking thumb, and then the one or two fingers thrown in. Roll, river, roll, long as you can be, longest river I've done seen, roll into the sea. Went like that.
And then, more of it. But you know, the strange thing is, James, I never heard that. It sounds like a James Taylor song, you know? I mean.
Yeah, it does.
You know? Not the oompa part, maybe so much at the beginning, but the way that the bass line goes down and goes to the, and all of that.
Ends on the minor.
Ends on the minor, exactly, yeah. In that.
Yeah, it does. It had a certain.
It hints at things you will write.
Yes.
If not, everybody, I think everybody here knows that you went off to London eventually and you recorded that first record. How old were you when you did that, James?
I guess I was 19 when I went to London and got my recording contract with Apple Records, with the Beatles. And that was such an amazing reversal of fortune for me. That was the door that opened and let me through to the life that I've lived ever since.
And
it was my big break. I'd been at it since, you know, when I came to New York in 1966, and instead of graduating high school, I came here and I started with Danny Korchmar, a band called The Flying Machine, which was, it was ill-fated, and we had problems, and you know, typical problems, and never got our recording deal that we needed. We signed one, but the people who signed it just they couldn't follow through with it. So, and after that, fell to pieces in '66. When I was 18, I went home to North Carolina to recover a little bit. I needed soup. I needed a bed. You know, I needed my parents. I needed to go home. You know, my dad actually heard me on the phone. I called him in North Carolina from New York, and the band had been broken up for about a month, and he could hear that I wasn't well, and he said, "You just stay right there." He got my address. He said, "You stay right there. I'll be there in 10 hours," and he was.
That's wonderful.
I just sat there for 10 hours, and my dad showed up in a station wagon and took me home. That's one of my treasures, that memory, that thing he did. I wrote a song about it called Jump Up Behind Me.
This land is a lovely green, it reminds me of my old home. Such children I've seldom seen, even in my own home. The sky's so bright and clean.
Well, speaking of that, one of the things that was so potent about your music when as a very young man, people first started paying attention to it, was that it seemed to be so amazingly emotionally accessible. It seemed to sum up so many of the longings of a generation. So many people, a song like Rainy Day Man or Something's Wrong. And then more famously in the next go round, in the next group of songs, Fire and Rain and those things. Was it strange and difficult to see your own experience turning into songs and then becoming these kinds of universal vehicles for other people's feelings?
Very strange indeed, and you know, I think that that's, you obviously you want success, you want to be heard, you want to be listened to and encouraged. But it's always that moment of going from the private thing, and in the case of a singer-songwriter who doesn't have a band who's sort of going there with him and a sort of a posse or a crowd or a tribe that's you're running with and doing it with, when you're doing it alone and by yourself, it is a very strange transition to make. And I wrote songs about that too. Hey, Mister, That's Me Up on the Jukebox, or Fading Away, or Company Man. Those are songs about, you know, the difficulty of starting off with a very private and personal thing. And as my friend David Crosby says, you know, the first album you make is the result of 10 years of work. Then you've got a year to make the next one, you know. And, but that those first songs weren't written with an audience in mind, except in the most general sense. They really were personal, like diary entries or poems that you write for yourself. But then when you take this stuff to market and engage the music business and the popular culture and all that stuff, it can be a very interesting thing to try to negotiate and to make, to go public with it and to make a living. I'm sure that writing has a similar, there's a similar thing to it when you take your work to market.
But it had to be, you were saying, it had to be peculiar because, yes, of course, it's true for everyone, but a writer, maybe six people read it. When a musician genuinely develops a following, it's millions of people who see your music as their internal, not just as your journal, but as their internal diary. And that's an extraordinarily rich time, must be in your life. What's the first song of that body of work that you feel, a lot of it you still perform, that you feel is strong, is a finished song that you feel good about?
I guess Something in the Way She Moves is probably the first song that I had written, Knocking Around the Zoo, and a song called Sunshine, Sunshine, before Something in the Way She Moves. And actually all the songs on the first album, some of them before, some of them after Something in the Way She Moves, but that was the first one that I thought really worked as a song, yeah.
You still do material from that period, and and I know you've talked about a lot. But one of the things that interests me, if you don't mind, just to fast forward a little bit, as a listener of yours, as a follower of yours, one of the things that seemed to me to be true, and I wonder if it was true, is that some in the kind of mid-70s, you were searching a bit for a sound, for work. And then beginning in the late 70s, you started doing a couple of things. You started doing covers for the first time. You started doing Motown covers, How Sweet It Is, and so on. And it seemed as though there was a kind of rebirth through sort of being free to do other people's work as well as yours and sort of shedding the skin of Sweet Baby James and of that material. Was that a fantasy, or did you feel some of that?
You know, it just wasn't very very carefully considered ahead of time. All of those cover tunes that I would do were things that would be thought of at the spur of the moment in the recording studio after we had already recorded two songs that day. That's the way it was with How Sweet It Is. That's the way it was with Handyman. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be paying for it anyway. So you still feel strong and energetic. And Cooch says, why don't we try How Sweet It Is?
How sweet.
James Taylor talking with Adam Gopnik at the New Yorker Festival. Ahead this hour, we'll hear a live performance from James Taylor, and later, Aria Levy will be in conversation with Lucinda Williams. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. James Taylor joined Adam Gopnik in conversation at the New Yorker Festival, and they talk there about how Taylor formed his very distinctive sound, which was so influenced by Brazilian music, and in particular, Antonio Carlos Jobim.
You have that beautiful song, Only a Dream in Rio. Did Brazilian music open up your ears and your musical vocabulary?
It sure did. I mentioned the Broadway stuff, the folk music, and the light classics that my parents listened to, and some satirical stuff, Tom Lehrer. The next level of that was what my brother Alex brought into the house. He brought Ray Charles and Joe Tex and Don Covey and the Hot Nuts and the, which were a beach music band. And his stuff extended into some light jazz. And one of them was that great album recorded in 1963 in 3 days here in Manhattan. Astro Gilberto, João Gilberto, Girl from Ipanema.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes.
And that stuff had a huge effect on me. I loved the chords. I loved the, for a guitarist, that Brazilian thing is just a rich vein to get into. And man, I couldn't get enough. So, and I, that song more recently, the. The idea of that song is it was sort of like one note samba. It's just that da na da 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 da, and then the changes,
the harmony move, change.
Underneath it, and that's a very Brazilian, very Jobim thing to do. So I was hugely impressed by that stuff, and it was a great source for me. What happened is I developed a little bit of a guitar style from playing Christmas carols. and hymns from school. God, that's Deutschland über alles, too, isn't it?
That is. That's the part you want to keep quiet, if you can, James. That influence.
I only learned.
Play that
I only
down
came
a bit.
To realize that later. We can cut. We can edit right here. Hi. So, yeah. I played hymns. I played Christmas carols, and it gave me that sort of very bedrock kind of. Western musical
Bach harmony,
that kind of thing. And from then I fell into the Beatles and Jobim, And it really, I found that I had enough of a technique to be able to adapt those things into it. But the technique itself, I think I'm playing Ray Charles, I think I'm playing Joe Beam, I think I'm playing Paul McCartney, Lennon McCartney, I think I'm playing Holland Dozier or Holland, I think I'm, you know, but actually, or Sam Cooke or Marvin Gaye, but it actually is put through this sort of narrow filter of my technique.
Of your guitar fingering.
And it makes it sound like James Taylor, like, you know, Carol's tune Up on the Roof, which we did all summer long, and we went back and forth between her version of it and mine. It started being like a... when this whole world starts a-getting me down, and people are just too much for me to face. Well, when I adapted the tune and we did it, it was like a... When this old world starts a-getting me down, and people are just too much for me to face. I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares are just right and deep. La 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 la
la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la
la la la la la la
la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la harmonies, and you have a James Taylor tune. It's just too painful to have James Taylor up here and not hear you play. Would you play a few things for us? Let's go.
Around the sun, never give up, never slow down, never grow old, never ever die young. Synchronize with the rising moon, even with the evening star, they were true love, all written in stone. They were never alone, they were never that far apart. And we couldn't bear to believe they might make it. We got to close our eyes, to cut up our losses into doable doses, and ration our tears and sighs. You can see them on the street on a Saturday night. Everyone used to run them down. They're a little too sweet, they're a little too tight. They're not enough tough for this town, though. We couldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole. No, it didn't seem to rattle at all. They were fused together, body and soul. That much more with their backs up against the wall. Never do let them fall prey to the dust and the rust and the ruin that names us, shames us, claims us all.
guess it had to happen someday soon. There wasn't nothing to hold them down. They would rise from among us like a big balloon. Take the sky and forsake the ground. Yes, other hearts were broken, and I know other dreams ran dry, but our golden one sailed on and on to another land beneath another sky. Let other hearts be broken, let other dreams run dry, let our golden one sail on and on to another land beneath another sky. Beneath another sky.
I'm going to play that first song, very early song, first presentable song, I think, that I ever wrote.
Well, it's something in the way she moves, looks my way or calls my name, that seems to leave this troubled world behind. And if I'm feeling down and blue, and troubled by some foolish game, she always seems to make me change my mind. I feel fine anytime that she's around me now. She's around me now, almost all the time. If I'm well, you can tell that she's been with me now. She's been with me now quite a long, long time, and I feel fine. Every now and then, things that I lean on lose their meaning, and I find myself leaning into places where I should never let me go. She has a power to go where no one else can find me, and to silently remind me of the happiness and good times that I know, you know. Well, I guess I just got to know them. It isn't what she's got to say, how she thinks or where she's been. To me, the words are nice the way they sound. I like to hear them best that way. Doesn't much matter what they mean. She says them mostly just to calm me down. I feel fine anytime that she's around me now. She's around me now. I mean, just about all the time. If I'm well, you can tell that she's been with me. She's been with me now quite a long time, quite a long, long time, and I feel fine. Mm-hmm.
I have been playing, I have two children, and for the last 16 years, I've been playing You Can Close Your Eyes for them every night when they go to sleep. They always ask me, Daddy, did you make up that song? And I say, I did, I actually.
Yes, sir.
But now they're here tonight, and they'll be aware that I didn't, actually. James did. But I wonder if on behalf of this audience, who I know are all moving their fingers, would you teach me to play that song properly?
I will, indeed, yes. So let's get a guitar.
Is there a guitar? Could I get one?
Guitar and plug it in.
Thank you.
I bring two in case. These are Olsen guitars made by a guy in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and he managed in 1985 to get one into a hotel room that I was checking into in Minneapolis, and I've never looked back. So this is the first one this is the most recent one he built. So I'll
take it home tonight. We're in D, which Miles Davis said was the key that belonged to you.
Well, it's true. I met Miles Davis once up on 94th Street, and it's one of those things that you take as with you as a great, the great man, indeed, that he noticed me enough to mention. He said, you know, D's your key.
The Oracle had spoken.
So that's it.
And D is your key. So we start on D, where it's...
The sun is surely sinking down.
That's good. Actually, before we go... Before we go any further, I sing this song at home, too, and I've actually more and more recently gotten used to singing it with my dear wife, Kim, who is here, and I'm going to pull it. She's going to kill me. Pull her up on stage. She's here somewhere. Oh, she is here.
Hi, Kim. Hello.
Good.
So this is sort of like open mic night.
That's open mic night. That's right. We are. We're going to go out with a whimper here. So. Again.
When the sun is surely sinking down, but the moon is slowly rising, so this whole world must still be spinning around. I still love you. So close your eyes. You can close your eyes. It's all right.
Great.
I don't know no love songs. I can't sing.
That was Adam Kopnik on the guitar, accompanied by James Taylor and his wife, Kim. Still ahead, Lucinda Williams on life, love, sex, and getting right with God.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and today's show was recorded at the New Yorker Festival, and we're talking to two of the top singer-songwriters in popular music. In 2012, staff writer Ariel Levy sat down with one of the most acclaimed American songwriters of recent years, Lucinda Williams. Williams has released 13 albums, and she's written songs for everyone, from Mary Chapin Carpenter to Tom Petty. She's a winner of 3 Grammy Awards, and now here's Lucinda Williams with Ariel Levy.
A lot of your music strikes me as really spiritual, and you've got God on your belt buckle, and you told me...
Get right with God.
Get right with God. Yeah. Right on your belt buckle, just like your song.
Yeah.
And you were telling me that you've got... That you had in your house naturally this wall of...
Crosses. Different crosses, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like art, Day of the Dead kind of stuff, and Santeria.
And you got, and both your grandfathers were ministers.
Methodist ministers, yeah.
So tell us a little bit, if you would, about the role that religion and God have played in your life and in your music. And I'm particularly interested in concepts of sin and redemption, which I think come up in your music a lot.
My dad's father, for instance, was a Methodist minister. But, you know, he was what I describe as a Christian in the true sense of the word. You know, he was... for women's rights. He was a CO in World War I and was involved in the Southern Tenant Union's farmer struggle and all of that, you know. And then my dad, by the time I was born and growing up and everything, my dad described himself as agnostic. So...
What about you? Do you consider yourself agnostic?
No. but I don't have... because I don't believe in original sin. So I'm not a Christian, you know, I guess. Except I feel like I live my life more like a Christian than a lot of Christians. You know, it's all, everybody knows what I'm talking about. You know, but I just love the folklore and the mythology and the symbolism of it all, you know.
One of the things I really envy about religious people is that they can walk through life with a sense of destiny. And it seems to me that a lot of artists have that same blessing, you know. Like, at what point in your life did you know or did you feel that music was your calling?
Well, at least probably from the time I was about 12 years old, which is when I started taking guitar lessons. And it was the same year I first heard Bob Dylan. Highway 61 Revisited in 1965. There was always a piano around the house because my mother played, you know. Music books would be laying around and music being played in the house. My dad was listening to everyone from Hank Williams to John Coltrane, Chet Baker, Lightnin' Hopkins, you know.
And so when did you start writing? When did you start doing your own songs?
Well, I mean, I was, you know, fooling around with it and everything, but from the age of probably about 13 or 14, you know.
And your father was this great poet, Miller Williams. Was he a big influence on you in terms of writing?
Yeah.
He encouraged you?
Yeah, he encouraged me. And I mean, you know, there were other writers, poets, and novelists in the house, you know, a lot. And see, he taught at different universities, so I grew up in that academic environment, you know, and it's very, you know, stimulating. And just, you know, he'd have people over at the house, and it would just be people like, you know, John Cleland Holmes and John Chardy and James Dickey, and that was the environment.
Tell us a little bit about when you first started playing music, singing as a job, you know, in New Orleans when you were real young and you were playing in bars. Was that a fun time in your life? Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the first little gig I got in New Orleans. Yeah, I was in between. Well, my dad always wanted me to, you know, get a degree in something so I could have something to fall back on. And we were encouraged to, you know, have a career, whatever it was. So I was at, I got into the University of Arkansas where he was teaching in 1971. And I was going down to the quarter, because we had lived there for a while when I was growing up. I went to high school there and everything. So I had some friends there and all. So I was going down to the French Quarter and hanging out. And there was this little folk club called Andy's on Bourbon Street, right in the middle of all the strip joints. It was really odd. And anyway, I got offered a little gig playing there, like, you know, three nights a week for tips, which was a huge deal for me. This was in 1972 or something, you know. So I called my dad and I said, you know, I don't want, instead of coming back to school in the fall, I want to stay down here and do this. And he said, okay. That was probably the biggest turning point in my entire, what became, you know, my career.
Because he gave you permission to be an artist,
permission.
Essentially.
I needed to have his permission, you know. And we were talking about that, like, it's important for, you know, kids to have at least one or someone they don't want to disappoint. It doesn't have to be one of your parents, but somebody, you know, that you don't want to disappoint them. You know, so that was my dad for me, so, you know.
And then another big turning point after that is when you get your first development deal. And you must have thought, and this is when you moved to L.A., and you must have thought, My ship is in. I made it.
I'm there. I've made it. I was on cloud nine.
Yeah.
Well, there was a guy at RCA at the time, and he really liked me and, you know, saw something there. So they used to do this back then. They called it a development deal. And this was in 1985, I guess. And they give you enough money to live on for 6 months or something. It was, and so I had enough. For the first time, I didn't have to work a day job, and all I had to do was, you know, write some songs, and then they send you in the studio to do a demo tape, and hopefully they sign you after that.
And so there were some great songs on that demo tape, weren't there?
The same ones that are ended up on the Rough Trade album. Passionate Kisses and Crescent City and all.
And Passionate Kisses was the first song that you won a Grammy for.
Yeah, that was Mary Chapin Carpenter.
Years later, not until 1994. But the Grammy, so she recorded it, you win for Best Country.
I won for Country Song of the Year. Yeah, that was kind of a funny thing. It was really because Mary Chapin Carpenter was being marketed in the country arena. She picked that song up and recorded it. And at the time, her label or whoever was in charge, you know, said, no, we don't want that to be the single. It's not country enough. And she stood her ground, and they put it out as a single, and then it won a Grammy for Country Song of the Year.
And so it wins a Grammy for Country Song of the Year, but it was on that first demo of yours that you did for the development deal, which they didn't pick up.
Right.
That's got to be gratifying.
I got passed on by everybody. Yeah, it's gratifying later on.
To win a Grammy for a song they didn't pick up?
Yeah.
I mean, you could just...
Well, I couldn't get signed for anything. I mean, because at the time... Back in the mid-'80s, there was no Americana, there was no alternative country, there was no, you know, all of this. So they didn't know. I literally fell in the cracks, according to them, between country and rock.
But in terms of music, you know, people always give you a lot of credit for having a lot of integrity and staying true to your sound, which I can certainly understand. But you think sometimes that that's been about fear.
It was, a lot of it was just, you know, when I was first starting out, I was, you know, terrified of being overproduced and all of this, you know, because I had seen other folk blues heroes kind of mine or who had made these horrible, horrendous albums. Like the 70s, you know, the disco thing came along and all of a sudden, you know.
So I think of you as one of the great erotic poets of our time. And and it seems like you're really comfortable and really uninhibited, as well as really brilliant writing and singing about sex. Is that, do you feel like?
Yes. I like to, the truth is I like to push people's buttons a little bit. I think it's from growing up as, you know, with my dad, a poet, and all the poets and everything. I mean, they didn't censor themselves. And that was one of the things my dad taught me about writing. Don't censor yourself. You know, so that's the way I approach songwriting. And although I like to do it in a sort of elegant, somewhat, you know, it's not like a punk thing. That's a whole different thing, you know. So I don't want to like cram it down people's throats.
Yeah, it's, you're trying to make people feel something. You're not trying to assault them.
Yeah.
But so it's, but it just made me, it is sort of punk. I was just thinking about, wasn't there a thing where a woman sort of, you were playing Essence and there was a woman at a show who sort of spontaneously,
oh my God,
invested in sexual, yeah, fervor?
This was at the House of Blues in New Orleans. And it was after Hurricane Katrina. So there was this really odd energy in the, you know, you could feel it in the whole city, really, this kind of, sort of kind of subliminal anger or something, you know. Anyway, so I was there with the band. We played Essence, and the place was packed, and I didn't see it. I didn't witness it, you know, but apparently there was a woman who was there who was masturbating, and they called the cops, and apparently she was kicking the policeman because she wasn't finished yet or something, which I could totally understand, you know. So I don't know if she was on ecstasy. I don't know what the hell. But
it's a very sexy song.
I felt this kind of little pride about that, you know? Like, you know.
Yeah.
Damn, I mean, that's pretty gutsy. Not ballsy. I hate saying that about when it's a woman. I hate that.
Has anything changed about the way you write songs?
I feel like I'm more confident now.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I'm actually writing more. I used to just barely have enough songs for one album.
Uh-huh.
But in the beginning, I mean, I was just so painfully shy, and I would just kind of look down like this, and, you know. And I still get nervous, you know, but it helps to have a great band behind you,
uh-huh,
you know, and have that connection and feel secure. And when I first started out, I really didn't think of myself as terms of being a great singer. I mean, so that's one reason I decided to learn how to write good songs.
Was it Emmy Lou Harris or somebody?
Emmy Lou Harris was another one.
But who said to you?
Oh, yeah, she said one time, you know, your limitations are your strength. Your limitations become your strength and all.
Well, speaking of great songwriting, great vocals, let's have a big round for Lucinda the Person.
All world is out tears. If we live in a world without tears, how would bruises find face to lap on? How would scars find skin to etch themselves into? How would broken find the bone? If we live in a world without tears, how would heartbeats know when to stop? How would blood know which body to flow outside of? How would bullets find the gun? And if we live in a world without tears, how would misery know which back door to walk through? How would trouble know which mind to live inside of? How would sorrow find a home? And if we live in a world without tears, how would bruises find the face to lie upon? How would scars find skin to etch themselves into? how it broke him on the bone. How it bullets find the guns. How it sorrow find a home. Thank you.
Ariel Levy talking with singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. And if you've missed any of the performances we heard today, you can find them at newyorkerradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm David Remnick. Please join me next week. And until then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Bradley Chi, Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Mengfei Chen. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.